I'm Ben Sawyer, and today we've got a little something special for you, something we're calling Crossroads. From time to time on weekends, Bob and I will be sharing episodes of podcasts that we think our audience might enjoy. And today, our first ever featured podcast is History Daily. History Daily is hosted by our friend Lindsey Graham. No, not Lindsey Graham, the senator, but Lindsey Graham, the podcaster extraordinaire. You might know Lindsey from some of the biggest podcasts in the country, including American Scandal and American History Tellers. Lindsey's newest endeavor, History Daily, drops new episodes every weekday featuring stories of events that happened on that date in the past. For today's episode, I've picked two recent History Daily episodes that I think work really well together. We're going to splice them together into one so you can go from one to the next. The first one is the story of Laika, the Soviet space dog, who on November 3rd, 1957, launched into space. And the second one is the story of Apollo 8, which sent the first crewed spacecraft to orbit the moon on December 21st, 1968. Both of these episodes are great on their own, but together I think they illustrate the firm lead that the Soviets had early on in the space race and the incredible effort that NASA and US scientists put into surpassing the Soviets by the end of the 1960s, which, as you know, will culminate in the United States getting to the moon first. I want to say a shout out to Lindsey Graham for actually approaching us with this idea. It's brilliant. I'm happy to share these with you, and you can know that if we're sharing episodes with you on our feed, they're ones that we really enjoy. So if you enjoy these episodes, you can go follow History Daily anywhere you get The Road to Now. Just go search them out, subscribe, and you'll get a new story about history every day in your feed on weekdays. Hope you guys enjoy this. We'll be back on Monday with a new episode. Thanks.
It's a cold night in 1957 in Moscow. The neon lights of a restaurant beam off the wet streets. In a dark alleyway, a young employee in a dirty apron exits out the back door. As he trudges out into the alley, taking out the trash, a swift, small movement catches his eye. It's a stray mutt. The man watches for a moment as the dog chomps on a chicken bone from an overturned garbage can. The dog stops eating, lifts up her head, and stares the man down. The restaurant worker tries to shoo her away, but the dog won't budge. So he steps over her, picks up the overturned garbage can, and empties his pail inside. As he puts the lid back on the can, he notices the dog's ribs. It's clear she hasn't eaten a good meal in ages, and she's in rough shape. But there's plenty of food inside, the man thinks. So he goes back to the kitchen to look for scraps. A few minutes later, he returns with a half-eaten chicken breast. But when he steps back out into the alley, the dog is gone, captured only moments earlier by a dog catcher. But she's not headed for the pound. Instead, she's on her way to make history. After 3 years of scavenging the streets, this mutt will end up over 1,600 miles from Moscow in the desert of Baikonur, Kazakhstan. The dog's been drafted into the Soviet space program, and she'll become the first animal ever to orbit the Earth. From Noiser and Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is History Daily. History is made every day. On this podcast, every day, we'll tell the true stories of the people and events that shaped our world. Today is November 3rd, Laika the Space Dog. It's October 1957, about a month before Laika's launch, and a cold wind blows over the choppy steppe of the Baikonur Desert, whistling through the scorched remains of rockets that never made it into space. This frigid wasteland is home to the Baikonur Cosmodrome, the heart of the Russian space program. Inside a building on the site, two men sit across a table from one another, Russian Premier Nikita Khrushchev and rocket scientist Sergei Korolev. Years earlier, in 1938, Korolev was falsely accused of obstructing Soviet space research. He was arrested then locked up and tortured in one of the many prison camps that make up the Soviet Gulag. Ultimately, though, he was acquitted of the crimes, but he's hardly a free man. He's now the Soviet's top scientist in their secret space program, hidden from the public eye. He's also the man beating America in the space race. Just yesterday, Korolev successfully shot the world's first satellite into orbit. Sputnik 1's launch and successful orbit is sending shockwaves through the West, and tensions between America and Russia are growing as the two countries make space the newest front in the Cold War. Since World War II, the Soviet Union and the United States have poured billions into rocket technology. And it's not just for national pride. Many see the domination of space as a distinct military advantage. But with the unmanned satellite Sputnik, the Soviets got into orbit first. Already, plans are in motion to get a Soviet cosmonaut there next. But at this stage, no one quite knows how a human will function in orbit. At their meeting, Khrushchev informs Korolev that in light of Sputnik 1's success, he wants another launch. He wants it to coincide with the 40th anniversary of Russia's Bolshevik Revolution on November 7th, and he wants it to be spectacular. Khrushchev's order gives Korolev only weeks to prepare a second launch, but it can't be a mere repeat performance. This Sputnik mission will be different. One of its primary objectives is to help determine how living creatures fare in orbit, and a small female dog will be the test subject. Launching a rocket into space is a type of mathematical gymnastics. Precision and balance are required. Every decision is a trade-off, including the size and weight of any passengers. The lighter the payload, the less fuel the rocket will require. Laika, the stray snatched from the streets of Moscow, is the ideal weight, 6 kilograms or 13 pounds. But there's another reason strays were chosen instead of well-bred dogs. Their scavenging lifestyle and exposure to Moscow's harsh winters and scorching summers make them more resilient and adaptable, or so the Soviet scientists hope. One thing is certain, training strays is cost-effective, and the leaders of the financially strained space program are looking to save money anywhere they can. For the dogs, the training is rigorous, including intense obedience and passivity tests. Dozens of dogs fail, but Laika passes with flying colors. Then the dogs are subjected to terrifying and deafening simulations of liftoff and spun in a centrifuge to emulate launch and gravitational effects. When it's her turn in the revolving contraption, Laika's pulse doubles and her blood pressure spikes. Still, Laika shows promise. She seems resilient and adaptable. Even the dog's kennels become a test. As Laika and the other canine candidates are kept in increasingly smaller cages to accustom them to the cramped quarters they'll encounter on their trip to space, many dogs panic, uncomfortable with the confinement. They'll acclimate or be cut from the program. At each stage of the training, the number of candidates drops, but Laika continuously adapts and quickly wins the favor of mission scientists. One of the most demanding challenges for the dogs is the change to their diet. Laika is forced to eat jellied chow. In a weightless environment, it's easier to serve than typical food, but not all dogs accept it. Those that can't are cut as well. By the end of the trials, the scientists narrow down their selection to just two dogs, a small white fluffy mutt named Albina and Laika. Meanwhile, Sergei Korolev's Sputnik 2 is ready. Korolev also has a launch date, November 3rd. To study and document the first animal in orbit, Korolev has armed the spacecraft with systems to feed biological data back to Earth and measure cosmic rays and solar radiation. He's also mounted a television camera to watch the first space dog on her mission in real time. The only thing left now is to choose which dog will go into orbit. Between Laika and Albina, the mission scientists still favor Laika, but the decision is not easily made. Sputnik 2 is a suicide mission. The scientists know Laika will not return. The objective is for Korolev to monitor and measure life signs in space, not to attempt a safe return to Earth. Dr. Vladimir Yazdovsky, one of the mission scientists, trained with Laika. For Yazdovsky, the idea of sending her up to her death is heartbreaking. Laika is one of the friendliest, sweetest dogs in the program. It's not fair, Yazdovsky thinks. Laika didn't sign up for this. But the mission will be a go, regardless of what is fair or not. Then, only days before Laika's launch, Dr. Yazdotsky has an idea. He puts Laika into her cage and drives her to his home. Once there, her cage is opened and Laika bounds out to play in the yard with Yazdotsky's children. For Laika and the kids, it's a happy moment. For Yazdotsky, it's bittersweet. He went on to say, "Laika was quiet and charming. I wanted to do something nice for her. She had so little time left to live." The next day, Yazdotsky brings Laika back to the training facility. Both Laika and Albina are scheduled for surgery to implant medical monitoring devices that will record and transmit their vitals throughout the mission. Next, Laika and Albina begin their journey from their training facility to the Baikonur Cosmodrome. But even there, training continues. The dogs are put inside the capsule and made familiar with the feeding systems. They need to learn, to feel comfortable, to stay calm. Because in a matter of days, Laika will be loaded on top of a rocket and blasted off into history. It's October 31st, a few days before Laika's launch. Laika is strapped inside the Sputnik 2 capsule. She remains calm as the launch crew around her secures her into what they all know is her casket. For the next 3 days, she will be stuck inside the cramped capsule, waiting for liftoff. A connected heater keeps Laika from freezing during the Baikonur desert nights, and by day, she remains confined and immobile until the day of the launch, November 3rd, 1957. It's a bitterly cold morning. As mission scientists prepare for launch by grooming her, Laika doesn't fuss. She doesn't seem worried or scared. She's oblivious that in just a few short hours, she will be the lone passenger on a historic flight. From the control room, Korolev watches nervously as the countdown begins. For the Soviets, the rush into space has been met with many disasters. Everyone at the Cosmodrome knows Laika might not even make it into space. Too many rockets never get off the launch pad. But Korolev has done his part. All he can do now is watch and wait, hoping Laika's flight will provide the data he needs for the Soviets to send a human into orbit. Soon, the countdown nears completion. Engines flicker, then roar to life. The rocket shudders and lurches. Laika is shaking inside the cabin. Sputnik 2 lifts off the pad. Immediately, the sensor's readings alarm the scientists. Laika's heart rate soars to 240 beats per minute. She's panicking, and her body signals her terror. For a moment, it looks like she might not survive the launch. The rocket continues to accelerate, surging upward and reaching the edge of space. Once there, the scientists slump in relief. Biological data confirmed. Laika is alive. And then, Laika makes her first turn around the planet. Korolev has successfully placed a living being into orbit for the first time, once more beating the Americans. Laika is not the first animal or living organism to reach space. The Americans have shot fruit flies and monkeys into space. None returned alive. The Russians sent two other dogs into space prior, but Laika is the first to orbit the Earth. Still, despite Korolev's success, Laika's flight hasn't gone according to plan. In the process of separating the Sputnik 2 capsule from the rocket, the thermal insulation tore. The thermal control system can't cope. The cabin's temperature is rising. Laika started the day on the freezing Kazakhstan steppe, but now the capsule's interior thermometer is reading 40 degrees Celsius, over 104 degrees Fahrenheit. The scientists monitoring Laika are worried. It has taken 3 hours for her heart rate to settle from launch, much longer than it took during ground tests. In all her training, she was never in a weightless environment. Laika grows increasingly uncomfortable and distressed. She's not the only one feeling the heat. The launch of Sputnik 2 with Laika aboard shocks the American people again. They fear that Soviet technology surpasses their own. Twice now, the Soviets have beaten the Americans to major milestones in the space race. Many fear there can be no catching up. As for Korolev, it's another feather in his cap. Laika has brought him a step closer to achieving one of his dreams, putting a human into orbit, and maybe one day, landing a person on the moon. As for Sputnik 2, there is no re-entry plan. Its batteries die and the computer shuts down on November 10, 1957. The craft ceases to transmit. Months later, in April 1958, Sputnik 2 re-enters Earth's atmosphere after 2,570 orbits. People in New York witness a fiery streak as Sputnik 2 burns up in the sky above them. After the launch, the Soviet press claims Laika survived 4 days in orbit before she died from overheating in the cabin. They claim her death was peaceful and painless. But decades later, the truth will be revealed. 4 hours into Laika's mission, she struggled as the cabin heated up. Somewhere between the fifth and sixth hour, the heat was too much and her organs began to give out. 7 hours into the flight, Korolev and the scientists stopped receiving signs of life. At the time, there is no controversy over the death of Laika in the press. The public doesn't question the use of dogs for experimentation. But outside of Russia, in the aftermath of Laika's mission, a fierce debate ensues. The experiments imposed on Laika and other space dogs were far from kind. Years later, Soviet scientists admitted their remorse. In 1998, Oleg Gidzenko, a scientist who worked with Laika, said, "Work with animals is a source of suffering to all of us. We treat them like babies who cannot speak. The more time passes, the more I'm sorry about it. We shouldn't have done it. We did not learn enough from this mission to justify the death of the dog." In the wake of Laika's tragic suicide mission in 1960, Korolev successfully sends two more dogs into orbit, Belka and Strelka, but each time Korolev manages to return them to Earth alive. These early experiments also made it possible for Korolev to shoot the first human into orbit. Yuri Gagarin circled the Earth in April 1961. History is overflowing with unjustified sacrifices. Whether Laika's sacrifice was necessary is uncertain, but through them, we learn how to progress, hopefully, into a better future. It's early morning, December 21st, 1968, at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Bill Anders, a 35-year-old rookie astronaut, sits in his spacecraft, the Apollo 8. Anders flexes his fingers in the stiff gloves of his pressure suit. He is uncomfortable. He's been strapped to his chair for almost 3 hours as the crew outside work on the rocket that will launch the Apollo 8 into space. Beside him are two other astronauts, Mission Commander Frank Borman and Command Module Pilot Jim Lovell. Their mission is a historic one. They will be the first men to leave Earth's orbit and the first to journey to the far side of the moon. But before they can achieve their mission, they have to get off the launch pad, and that's perhaps the most dangerous part. Anders is tired of waiting, but his fellow astronauts, Borman and Lovell, know that this is all part of the process. The two of them have been to space together before, on a mission a few years back. But this mission is different, and all three astronauts know it. The Saturn V rocket that will take them into space is the biggest and most powerful ever made. It's as tall as a 36-story building and is filled with hundreds of thousands of gallons of liquefied fuel. Today will be only the third time a Saturn V rocket has taken off and the first time the rocket will carry a crew. As the countdown enters its final moments, Anders' eyes flick over the constellation of dials and switches on the instrument panel in front of him. He quickly scans for any last-minute errors, any warning lights, but there's nothing, and so the mission will continue. At 9 seconds before launch, the Saturn V engines roar to life. The cabin shakes around Anders and the other two astronauts as the rocket blasts out 7.5 million pounds of thrust. The metal arms that hold the rocket to the launch pad detach, and for a moment, the Saturn V rocket is free, standing alone on a ball of flame. This is the point of greatest peril. If the engines fail now, the entire rocket will collapse to the Earth and explode. But then, like a skyscraper hurling itself into the sky, the Saturn V rocket surges upward, clears the launch pad, and soars into the clouds. Apollo 8 and its crew are on their way into space. Hundreds of thousands of people watch the launch on the ground in Florida, and millions more watch on television sets around the world. 1968 has been a year of violence and discord in America and overseas. There have been assassinations, riots, and wars. For many of the people watching this momentous event, the launch of Apollo 8 and its daring mission into space provides something that has been desperately missing: hope. From Noiser and Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is History Daily. History is made every day. On this podcast, every day, we tell the true stories of the people and events that shaped our world. Today is December 21st. Apollo 8 goes to the moon. It's September 12, 1962, 6 years before the launch of Apollo 8. In the bright Texas sun, John F. Kennedy, President of the United States, steps up to a podium and looks out at the sea of faces before him. 40,000 people have packed into a football stadium at Houston's Rice University to hear the president speak. He's come to tell them why he believes America should land a man on the moon. America is losing the space race. Their Cold War rivals, the Soviet Union, shocked the world in 1957 by launching the satellite Sputnik into orbit. Then in April 1961, they beat the Americans once again by sending the first man into space, Yuri Gagarin. For Kennedy, who has only been president a few months, it was a national humiliation, and one he took personally. Previously, he had shown little interest in the American space program, but after Gagarin's flight, that all changed. If there was going to be a space race, Kennedy was determined that the United States should win it. The Soviet Union, though, had a head start. So any goal the president set had to be ambitious enough that America would have time to catch up. And that's why he resolved to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. But since announcing this plan to a joint session of Congress in 1961, Kennedy has struggled to win over the public, to explain why this matters and why it must be done now. So he has come to Rice University in Houston, Texas, to address these students and the nation. The government is building a new manned spacecraft center in Houston. In his speech, Kennedy ties the construction of that center into Houston's history as a frontier town. According to the president, the space program is the latest incarnation of America's pioneering spirit.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
It's a romantic, patriotic vision, and a compelling one. Ultimately, Kennedy's optimistic vision will inspire the public support. In September 1963, the Houston Space Center opens. 2 months later, however, on another visit to Texas, President Kennedy is assassinated as he rides his motorcade through the city of Dallas. But the pioneering spirit he spoke of at Rice University will not die with him. It's August 1968, 5 years after President Kennedy's assassination. At the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, engineer George Lowe hurries down a corridor to a conference room. Lowe is manager of the Apollo Spacecraft Program Office. It's his job to make sure the new vessels that will take men to the moon are ready to fly. And he's just come back from vacation with an idea that could save the Apollo space program. Kennedy's goal of putting a man on the moon by 1970 is hugely ambitious. NASA, the American Space Agency, is well-funded, but their Apollo space program has been plagued by technical problems and human tragedy. Just the year before, on January 27, 1967, three astronauts lost their lives in a fire during a routine test on the launch pad. The accident set the Apollo program back by months and resulted in a massive redesign of the spacecraft. It was George Lowe who led those efforts. There are three major components to an Apollo flight. First, the Saturn V rocket that launches the astronauts' spacecraft out of Earth's orbit. Second, the command and service module that carries them towards the moon. And third, the lunar module, nicknamed the LEM, that takes the astronauts down to the surface of the moon. NASA has had trouble with all three components. But right now, it's the LEM that has George Lowe worried. The Apollo 8 mission is meant to be the LEM's first test flight. On this mission, NASA has planned to test the module's capabilities in an Earth orbit. The Apollo 8 mission is meant to be the LEM's first test flight. But the lunar module is nowhere near ready. George Low knows that if NASA is forced to delay the Apollo 8 mission, all subsequent missions will also be pushed back. And if that happens, there's a real danger NASA will miss President Kennedy's end-of-the-decade deadline. So Low sits down to meet with other senior staff in Houston to lay out his new plan. Instead of waiting for the LEM to be ready, Low proposes something even more ambitious than the original mission. Low suggests that they send the Apollo 8 command module, without the LEM, on a mission to the moon. The astronauts won't be able to land on the moon, but they will be able to navigate to it and maneuver in and out of lunar orbit. As Low explains, such a mission would be invaluable. It would prove that NASA can make the calculations necessary to fly to the moon, and it would keep the Apollo program on target for a moon landing in the summer of 1969. Low's plan is approved, but there are many who doubt it will succeed. The Apollo 8 command module has flown just once with astronauts on board, and even then, only in Earth's orbit. Now, NASA wants to send three astronauts all the way to the moon. It's risky. Even the slightest miscalculation could kill the crew. And another NASA tragedy will not only mean missing Kennedy's deadline, it would jeopardize the entire American space program altogether. It's December 22, 1968, 18 hours after Apollo 8 blasted off from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. On board the cramped spaceship, astronauts Bill Anders and Jim Lovell try to keep quiet as they test out navigation systems. Floating in zero gravity beneath their feet is Mission Commander Frank Borman. It's his shift to rest, but Borman can't sleep. The constant radio chatter and the hum of instruments and machinery is keeping him awake, and now he's beginning to feel sick. Later, it will be determined that Borman is suffering from space adaptation syndrome, a condition that affects one in three people in zero gravity. But in this moment, Borman has no idea what's ailing him, so he forces his eyes shut and tries to sleep it off. The astronauts are only a third of the way to the moon. They have already traveled further in space than any other human beings in history, and through the tiny windows of their spacecraft, they are the first people to have seen the whole of the Earth at once. The men didn't expect to be part of the Apollo 8 mission. Their original assignment was Apollo 9, due early the following year. But when lunar module production fell behind schedule and NASA changed the parameters of the mission, the crews of Apollo 8 and 9 were switched. Borman and his men had just 16 weeks to train for their new assignment. At first, Bill Anders was disappointed with the swap. He was a lunar module pilot on a mission without a lunar module. But in the weeks building up to the launch, Anders realized what an incredible opportunity Apollo 8 was. If all went well, he would be among the first three people ever to leave Earth behind and see the dark side of the moon. But not all is going well. Today, as he floats in zero gravity, Anders hears a retching noise and looks down as a glob of Frank Borman's vomit drifts past his chin. Anders and Lovell help their shivering commander to his chair and strap him in. Lovell and Anders clean up as best they can while they debate whether to tell Mission Control in Houston. Borman insists absolutely not. He doesn't want anyone to know. But if Lovell and Anders fall sick too, the whole mission will be in danger. They have to tell Houston. A hurried radio conference is held between the doctors on the ground and the astronauts on board. They decide Borman has either a 24-hour stomach sickness or a bad reaction to a sleeping pill. Either way, the mission will continue. It's Christmas Eve, 1968. After 3 days journeying through space, Apollo 8 has finally reached the moon. On board the spacecraft, the astronauts open a locker and dig out a handheld camera in order to give the world its first look at the moon close up through a live television broadcast. It's been 86 hours since Apollo 8 left the Kennedy Space Center. Traveling through space at almost 4,000 feet per second, the spacecraft needed a precisely calculated engine burn to slow down enough to enter the moon's orbit. Too short a burn, and the ship might careen off into space. Too long, and they risk becoming another crater on the moon's surface. Luckily, the precise calculations did not fail them. A 4-minute and 7-second long burn slowed down the Apollo 8 command module just enough. Now, in lunar orbit, Apollo 8 skims over the surface of the moon some 60 miles up. Over 200,000 miles away on Earth, hundreds of millions of people watch as the astronauts describe what they are seeing through the ship's tiny windows. For Frank Borman, the moon is an expanse of nothing. Jim Lovell calls the vast loneliness he sees below awe-inspiring. And to Bill Anders, the moon and the stars beyond seem stark and forbidding. But for all three men, the most spectacular sight of all is Earth, a glowing orb of color and life floating in endless black. Near the end of their broadcast, Anders reads from the book of Genesis.
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep.
The astronauts take turns reading verses until Borman ends the broadcast with these words.
And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
By the end of their mission, the crew of Apollo 8 will have journeyed farther than any other humans in history. They will have seen the far side of the moon and taken more than 800 pictures of the surface. But it will be their message to the good Earth that will be remembered forever. It's December 27th, 1968. 6 days after Apollo 8 left Earth. In the skies over the North Pacific, three bright red and white parachutes burst open. The Apollo 8 spacecraft slung underneath sways down toward the sea and splashes gently into the waves. The outside of Apollo 8 is scorched from its trip through Earth's atmosphere. But the astronauts inside, Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders, are alive and well. Their mission has been a complete success. The navigation to the moon and entry into lunar orbit proved NASA's technology worked. It's a huge step towards meeting President Kennedy's ambition of putting an American on the moon by 1970. And indeed, just 7 months later, in July 1969, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin become the first men to walk on the moon. But Apollo 8 is more than just a technical triumph. People all around the world followed Borman, Lovell, and Anders from the moment they took off to the moment they splashed down in the Pacific. One in four people on the Earth tuned in for their famous Christmas Eve broadcast. And for many of these viewers, 1968 was a difficult year. The civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. was shot dead in April. The politician Bobby Kennedy, younger brother of the assassinated President John Kennedy, was killed in June. And in Vietnam, America was on the verge of losing its unpopular war with the North Vietnamese. But for a brief few days in December, people across the world looked up to follow the journey of three men, and through them saw the world in a whole new way. On his return, the commander of Apollo 8, Frank Borman, will receive countless messages of congratulations, but there will be one telegram he will remember above all, an anonymous note that reads simply, "Thank you. You saved 1968. Next on History Daily, December 22, 1894. A scandal known as the Dreyfus Affair begins when a Jewish captain in the French army is convicted of treason for allegedly passing military secrets to the Germans. From Noiser and Airship, this is History Daily, hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Music and sound design by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by William Simpson. Executive producers are Stephen Walter for Airship, and Pascal Hughes for Noiser.